This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Andrew Smith and Jill Robbins have a story on Iranian women choosing not to wear a head covering called the hijab. In recent weeks, the Iranian government has increased efforts to enforce its law requiring women to wear the hijab. John Russell has this week's Everyday Grammar lesson on inflation. Later, we present the next part in our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
more Iranian women are choosing not to wear the head covering called the hijab. Since the early years of Iran's Islamic Revolution, women have been required to cover their heads by law. Today, many public signs urge women to wear head coverings to honor their mothers. In recent weeks, the Iranian government has increased efforts to enforce its law requiring women to wear the hijab. It has closed some businesses for serving women not covering their heads. The government also has given warnings in public places and sent text message warnings to drivers carrying women without head coverings. More women have chosen not to wear the hijab after months of protests following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. Amini died in September 2022 while being detained by police for wearing her hijab too loosely in public. Some women say they are fighting for more freedom in Iran and for a better future for their daughters. They also say the government will not be able to enforce the hijab law if more women refuse to wear it. Do they want to close down all businesses? Said Shervin, a 23-year-old student in Tehran. If I go to a police station, will they shut it down too?
However, the women worry about risk. The women who spoke to the Associated Press only gave their first names because they feared punishment. Vida is 29. She said a decision by her and two of her friends to stop covering their hair in public is about more than headscarves. This is a message for the government. Leave us alone, she said. Before September, it was rare to see women without hijabs. Today, it is common in some areas of Tehran to see women without them. Many Muslim women wear their hijab as a sign of respect for God and modesty in front of men outside of their families. Before the 1979 revolution, many middle and upper-class women chose not to wear the hijab. In 1983, head coverings in public became required by law. Punishments for breaking the hijab law include fines and up to 2 months in prison. In early April, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah al-Khomeini, declared that removing the hijab is not Islamically or politically permissible. He also claimed that enemy spies were the ones pushing women not to wear the hijab. On April 25th, officials closed a large shopping mall in northern Tehran for several days. The move came after women with their hair showing were seen spending time with men in a bowling alley.
"It is a collective punishment," said Nadin Khosra, a 32-year-old salesman at a clothing shop in the mall. "They closed a mall with hundreds of workers over some customer's hair?" The reformist Iranian newspaper Sharg said police have shut down over 2,000 businesses across the country over admitting women not wearing the hijab. Some experts warn that business owners might push back against the government. However, there are signs the government might enforce the rules even more severely. Government offices no longer provide services to women not covering their hair, after some had in recent months. Some religious leaders said the government should use soldiers as well as the all-volunteer Basij force of Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard to enforce the hijab law. Police also said cameras with artificial intelligence will find women not wearing their head covering. However, it is unclear if such a system is currently working. 33-year-old Soraya said she is already fighting for a bigger goal by going without a headscarf. "I don't want my daughter to be under the same ideologic pressures that I and my generation lived through," she said. "This is for a better future for my daughter." I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Inflation worries people around the world. Argentina, Egypt, the United States, and many other places. But how do English speakers discuss inflation in everyday situations? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore a point of connection between grammar and the economy. Inflation is a noun. It means an increase in the price of goods and services. Inflation reduces the purchasing power of money that is earned from work or saved. The Online Etymology Dictionary says inflation's meaning of enlargement of prices was first recorded in 1838 in American English. There also is a verb form, inflate. The Online Etymology Dictionary says the economic meaning of inflate dates to 1843. The dictionary adds, the verb inflate is a product of back formation. Back formation means that a verb is created from an existing noun. When we use the verb inflate, we often, but do not always, use it with a direct object. You might read something like this.
Economists worry that supply chain issues could inflate prices.
Here, the plural noun prices is the object of the verb inflate. In some cases, we use inflate without a direct object. For example, you might read something like this.
Economists worry that prices could inflate.
So, we have inflation, the noun, and inflate, the verb. But if we compare how common they are, we reach a clear finding. Inflation is much more commonly used. Google's Ngram Viewer contains information from English books dating from 1800 to 2019. Using Ngram Viewer, we find that the word inflation started becoming more common in the 1920s. That trend has more or less continued to the present time. So, if you are discussing inflation, you are more likely to hear the noun form than the verb form. When we use inflation in the subject position of the sentence, we often use a few verbs in the predicate. For example, when inflation goes up, we often use verbs such as increase, rise, or soar. We often, but do not always, add more information after the verb. So you might hear a person say,
"Inflation is increasing."
Or,
"Inflation is increasing quickly."
Or,
"Inflation is rising."
The strongest version would probably involve the verb soar, meaning to go very high.
"Inflation is soaring."
On the other hand, when inflation is going down, we often use verbs such as decrease, drop, or decline. So you might hear a person say,
"Inflation is decreasing." "Inflation is dropping."
Or,
"Inflation is declining."
We can also use any of these verbs to ask questions about inflation. So you might ask, "Why is inflation increasing? Why is inflation soaring? Or why is inflation dropping?" Let's take some time to work with these ideas. Use the verb rise to ask about the reason for inflation. Pause the audio to consider your answer. Here is one possible answer.
"Why is inflation rising?"
Now use the verb soar to make a statement about a quick increase in inflation in recent months. Pause the audio to consider your answer. Here is one possible answer.
"Inflation has soared in recent months."
Please note that there are other possible answers to these questions. The next time you read or hear about inflation, pay careful attention to the terms and structures that are used. Inflation is a big, difficult subject, but mastering some of the basic terms and ideas related to it can be a big help in everyday discussions or on English speaking and writing tests. I'm John Russell.
Just heard John Russell present this week's Everyday Grammar. John joins us now to talk a little bit more about the lesson. Welcome, John.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
In the report, you describe some ways we talk about inflation. I'm sure there was a lot of information that you did not include. What's another important idea about inflation that you didn't have time to explore in the lesson?
That's a great question. The first idea that comes to mind is this. We often use inflation with another noun, rate. Rate means the speed at which something happens in an amount of time. So we often talk about the inflation rate or the rate of inflation.
And we often express the inflation rate as a percentage. For example, 2%, 6%, 90%, and so on.
That's right. Different countries have different inflation goals. At least in the long term, the U.S. aims for a 2% rate of inflation.
Thanks for sharing that information with us, John. And thanks again for coming on the show.
You're welcome. See you next time.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Imagine a time machine. You've just climbed into it for the purpose of visiting the United States in the 1950s. What would you expect to find? In the 1950s, America was a nation whose population was growing as never before. It was a nation where the popular culture of television was both reflecting and influencing its lifestyle. But it was also a nation that believed it was on the edge of nuclear war. Americans were happy to put World War II behind them. The war ended in 1945. People were hopeful. They thought the world would be peaceful for a while. By 1950, however, political tensions were high again. The United States and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II. But after the war, they became enemies in what came to be known as the Cold War. Communists took control of one Eastern European nation after another. The Soviet Union, led by Joseph Stalin, strengthened its armed forces. However, the United States thought America alone possessed the most powerful weapon of all, the atomic bomb. But in 1949, a United States Air Force plane discovered strange conditions in the atmosphere. What was causing them? The answer came quickly. The Soviet Union had tested its own atomic bomb. The nuclear race was on. The two nations competed to build weapons of mass destruction. A doomsday clock on the cover of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists warned of a growing danger of nuclear destruction. Members of that group were afraid of what science had produced, and even more afraid of what it could produce. By 1949, the time on the doomsday clock was 3 minutes to midnight. In 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea. The Korean War increased efforts in the United States to develop a weapon even more deadly than the atomic bomb. That weapon was the hydrogen bomb. The Soviets were also working to develop their own hydrogen bomb. Some Americans built bomb shelters in their backyards, hoping to have a safe place for their families in case of a nuclear attack. Other Americans, however, were tired of being afraid. After years of sacrifice, they wanted to enjoy the good life in a growing economy. 1952 was a presidential election year. Americans elected Dwight Eisenhower, a military hero of World War II. The years after the war produced the baby boom generation. In 1950, there were 24 million young children in America. By 1960, that number was 35 million. More families meant the need for more houses, and bigger families needed bigger houses. In 1950 alone, almost 1.5 million new homes were built in America. Most of these new houses were located in suburbs, the areas outside cities. People moved to the suburbs because they thought the schools there were better than city schools. They also liked having more space
for their children to play in. More space meant children had room to lay out electric train sets. In a lot of American homes, playing with electric trains was an activity that brought the whole family together. Television ads for Lionel Trains even featured baseball great Joe DiMaggio.
Lionel Trains proudly present the Joe DiMaggio Show, starring the Yankee Clipper, Joe DiMaggio himself.
The late 1950s brought the Barbie doll and a big circular tube of colorful plastic called the hula hoop. People had to learn to move their hips in a circular motion, like a hula dancer in Hawaii, to spin it around their body. Hula hoops became hugely popular in America. Also popular was the poodle cut, not for dogs, but for women who wanted to look stylish. They fixed their hair into lots of small curls, like the hair on a poodle. Actress Mary Martin had made the poodle cut famous in the musical South Pacific. That play opened on Broadway in New York in 1949 and ran into the early 1950s.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend.
In Hollywood, one of the biggest movie stars of the 1950s was Marilyn Monroe. She starred in films like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in 1953. Her platinum blonde hairstyle also became popular among American women.
I woke up this morning, you know, and the sun was shining, and it was nice, and all that type of stuff. And the first thing, I saw you. And I said, no, boy, this is going to be one terrific day.
Another famous actor was James Dean, best known for the 1955 movie Rebel Without a Cause. That same year, he died in a car accident at the age of 24. In literature, there were writers and poets who came to be known as the Beat Generation. These included Jack Kerouac, Gregory Corso, and Allen Ginsberg. To them, much of life in 1950s America was empty and meaningless. The painter Jackson Pollock represented a spirit of rebellion in art. Pollock would drop paint onto a canvas. What did his works mean? People had to decide for themselves. In music, the rebel was Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
Baby, Elvis was a 21-year-old truck driver when he sang on television for the first time. Some parents and religious leaders thought he was a bad influence. They thought the way he moved his body to the music was too suggestive. But young people screamed for more. They listened to Elvis's music on records, on the radio, and on the television program American Bandstand. American Bandstand became the most popular dance party in America. Every week, young people danced to the latest songs in front of the TV cameras. But it wasn't all rock and roll.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Out of the mist, your voice is calling. 'Tis twilight time.
Whether on bandstand-type television programs or at local record hops or at home, young Americans and their parents dance cheek-to-cheek to romantic ballads as well. Television in the 1950s included dramas acted live every week. and there were quiz shows and game shows and comedy programs. If Elvis was the king of rock and roll, Lucille Ball was the queen of comedy. During the 1950s, millions of Americans watched I Love Lucy. Lucille Ball starred with her husband, Desi Arnaz. They played Lucy and Ricky Ricardo. Ricky is a Cuban band leader in New York. Lucy is a housewife who wishes she could be famous like her husband.
What do I have to do?
You're going to get me back on the television show.
How?
I don't know how. But if you don't...
All right.
I will,
Ricky. I'll get you back on the show. Don't even think of what you'll do if I don't.
Lucille Ball and I Love Lucy were both big influences on generations of entertainers and TV comedy producers. Variety shows offered a mix of entertainment. Americans watched shows hosted by comics like Milton Berle, Jackie Gleason, and Sid Caesar. Ed Sullivan was not a comedian, but for years, his show brought new acts into American homes every Sunday night. Television shows were all in black and white. But one night in 1953, Americans got their own time machine glimpse into the future of TV. It happened with an announcement during Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows.
This is Richard Harkness in Washington. This week will long be remembered in the annals of television. For on Thursday, December 17th, the Federal Communications Commission approved compatible color television.
That meant that owners of TV sets could still watch programs broadcast in color in black and white instead of having to buy a new set. Color TV's popularity grew quickly, and the prices of color TVs came down, meaning more color TVs in American homes and more programs produced in color.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
During the 1950s, most of the people who appeared on television were white. If black actors appeared, they were usually in jobs working for white people. But in real life, a civil rights movement was beginning to gather strength. Legal battles were fought to end racial separation, especially in public schools. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court made a historic ruling. The case was known as Brown versus Board of Education. The court ruled that the requirement in some states for racially separate schools was unconstitutional. The court rejected the idea that schools for black students could be separate but equal to those attended by white students. By the 1960s, the civil rights movement would shake American society. Dwight Eisenhower was president for most of the 1950s. He faced the problems of communism, nuclear threats, and racial tensions. Ike had a calm way of speaking to the public. Many Americans saw him as a fatherly president. They thought that even in a dark and dangerous world, everything would be all right. Were they correct? We'll try to answer that in future programs.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.